was watching him almost nervously, as though waiting for his opinion. "It's a bit small," said Ron quickly. "Not like that room you had with the Muggles. And I'm right underneath the ghoul in the attic. He's always banging on the pipes and groaning." But Harry, grinning widely, said, "This is the best house I've ever been in." Ron's ears went pink. Chapter 4. At Flourish and Blots. Life at the Burrow was as different as possible from life on Privet Drive. The Dursleys liked everything neat and ordered. The Weasleys' house burst with the strange and unexpected. Harry got a shock the first time he looked in the mirror over the kitchen mantelpiece, and it shouted, "Tuck your shirt in, Scruffy!" The ghoul in the attic howled and dropped pipes whenever he felt things were getting too quiet, and small explosions from Fred and George's bedroom were considered perfectly normal. What Harry found most unusual about life at Ron's, however, wasn't the talking mirror or the clanking ghoul. It was the fact that everybody there seemed to like him. Mrs. Weasley fussed over the state of his socks and tried to force him to eat fourth helpings at every meal. Mr. Weasley liked Harry to sit next to him at the dinner table so that he could bombard him with questions about life with Muggles, asking him to explain how things like plugs and the postal service worked. "Fascinating," he would say as Harry talked him through using a telephone. "Ingenious, really. How many ways Muggles have found of getting along without magic." Harry heard from Hogwarts one sunny morning about a week after he arrived at the Burrow. He and Ron went down to breakfast to find Mr. and Mrs. Weasley and Ginny already sitting at the kitchen table. The moment she saw Harry, Ginny accidentally knocked her porridge bowl to the floor with a loud clatter. Ginny seemed very prone to knocking things over whenever Harry entered a room. She dived under the table to retrieve the bowl and emerged with her face glowing like the setting sun. Pretending he hadn't noticed this, Harry sat down and took the toast Mrs. Weasley offered him. "Letters from school," said Mr. Weasley, passing Harry and Ron identical envelopes of yellowish parchment, addressed in green ink. "Dumbledore already knows you're here, Harry. Doesn't miss a trick, that man. You two have got them too," he added, as Fred and George ambled in, still in their pajamas. For a few minutes there was silence as they all read their letters. Harry's told him to catch the Hogwarts Express as usual from King's Cross Station on September 1st. There was also a list of the new books he'd need for the coming year. Second-year students will require The Standard Book of Spells, Grade 2, by Miranda Goshawk, Break with a Banshee by Gilderoy Lockhart, Gadding with Ghouls by Gilderoy Lockhart, Holidays with Hags by Gilderoy Lockhart, Travels with Trolls by Gilderoy Lockhart, Voyages with Vampires by Gilderoy Lockhart, Wanderings with Werewolves by Gilderoy Lockhart, Year with the Yeti by Gilderoy Lockhart. Fred, who had finished his own list, peered over at Harry's. "You've been told to get all Lockhart's books, too," he said. "The new Defense Against the Dark Arts teacher must be a fan. Bet it's a witch." At this point, Fred caught his mother's eye and quickly busied himself with the marmalade. "That lot won't come cheap," said George, with a quick look at his parents. "Lockhart's books are really expensive."
"Well, we'll manage," said Mrs. Weasley, but she looked worried. "I expect we'll be able to pick up a lot of Ginny's things second-hand."
"Oh, are you starting at Hogwarts this year?" Harry asked Ginny. She nodded, blushing to the roots of her flaming hair, and put her elbow in the butter dish. Fortunately, no one saw this except Harry, because just then Ron's elder brother Percy walked in. He was already dressed, his Hogwarts prefect badge pinned to his sweater vest. "Morning, all," said Percy briskly. "Lovely day." He sat down in the only remaining chair, but leapt up again almost immediately, pulling from underneath him a molting grey feather duster. At least that's what Harry thought it was, until he saw that it was breathing.
"Errol," said Ron, taking the limp owl from Percy and extracting a letter from under its wing. "Finally, he's got Hermione's answer. I wrote to her saying we were going to try and rescue you from the Dursleys."
He carried Errol to a perch just inside the back door and tried to stand him on it, but Errol flopped straight off again,
So Ron lay him on the draining board instead, muttering, "Pathetic." Then he ripped open Hermione's letter and read it out loud. "Dear Ron and Harry, if you're there, I hope everything went all right and that Harry is okay, and that you didn't do anything illegal to get him out, Ron, because that would get Harry into trouble too. I've been really worried, and if Harry is all right, will you please let me know at once? But perhaps it would be better if you used a different owl, because I think another delivery might finish your one off. I'm very busy with schoolwork, of course." "How can she be?" said Ron in horror. "We're on vacation. And we're going to London next Wednesday to buy my new books. Why don't we meet in Diagon Alley? Let me know what's happening as soon as you can. Love from Hermione."
"Well, that fits in nicely. We can go and get all your things then, too," said Mrs. Weasley, starting to clear the table. "What are you all up to today?"
Harry, Ron, Fred, and George were planning to go up the hill to a small paddock the Weasleys owned. It was surrounded by trees that blocked it from view of the village below, meaning that they could practice Quidditch there, as long as they didn't fly too high. They couldn't use real Quidditch balls, which would have been hard to explain if they had escaped and flown away over the village. Instead, they threw apples for one another to catch. They took turns riding Harry's Nimbus 2000, which was easily the best broom. Ron's old shooting star was often outstripped by passing butterflies. 5 minutes later, they were marching up the hill, broomsticks over their shoulders. They had asked Percy if he wanted to join them, but he had said he was busy. Harry had only seen Percy at mealtime so far. He stayed shut in his room the rest of the time. "Wish I knew what he was up to," said Fred, frowning. "He's not himself. His exam results came the day before you did. 12 OWLs, and he hardly gloated at all." "Ordinary wizarding levels," George explained, seeing Harry's puzzled look. "Bill got 12, too. If we're not careful, we'll have another head boy in the family. I don't think I could stand the shame." Bill was the oldest Weasley brother. He and the next brother, Charlie, had already left Hogwarts. Harry had never met either of them, but knew that Charlie was in Romania studying dragons and Bill in Egypt working for the Wizards Bank, Gringotts. "Don't know how Mum and Dad are going to afford all our school stuff this year," said George after a while. 5 sets of Lockhart books, and Ginny needs robes and a wand and everything." Harry said nothing. He felt a bit awkward. Stored in an underground vault at Gringotts in London was a small fortune that his parents had left him. Of course, it was only in the wizarding world that he had money. You couldn't use galleons, sickles, and canuts in muggle shops. He had never mentioned his Gringotts bank account to the Dursleys. He didn't think their horror of anything connected with magic would stretch to a large pile of gold. Mrs. Weasley woke them all early the following Wednesday. After a quick 6 bacon sandwiches each, they pulled on their coats, and Mrs. Weasley took a flower pot off the kitchen mantelpiece and peered inside. "We're running low, Arthur," she sighed. "We'll have to buy some more today. Oh, well, guests first. After you, Harry, dear." And she offered him the flower pot. Harry stared at them all watching him. "Well, what am I supposed to do?" he stammered. "He's never travelled by flu powder," said Ron suddenly. "Sorry, Harry, I forgot." "Never?" said Mrs. Weasley. "But how did you get to Diagon Alley to buy your school things last year?"
"I went on the underground."
"Really?" said Mr. Weasley eagerly. "Were there escapators? How exactly—"
"Not now, Arthur," said Mrs. Weasley. "Flu powder's a lot quicker, dear, but goodness me, if you've never used it before—"
"He'll be all right, Mum," said Fred. "Harry, watch us first." He took a pinch of glittering powder out of the flower pot, stepped up to the fire, and threw the powder into the flames. With a roar, the fire turned emerald green and rose higher than Fred, who stepped right into it, shouted, "Diagon Alley!" and vanished.
"You must speak clearly, dear," Mrs. Weasley told Harry as George dipped his hand into the flower pot, "and be sure to get out at the right grate."
"The right what?" said Harry nervously, as the fire roared and whipped George out of sight, too.
"Well, there are an awful lot of wizard fires to choose from, you know, but as long as you've spoken clearly—"
"He'll be fine, Molly, don't fuss," said Mr. Weasley, helping himself to flu powder too.
"But, dear, if he gets lost, how would we ever explain to his aunt and uncle?"
"They wouldn't mind," Harry reassured her. Dudley would think it was a brilliant joke if I got lost up a chimney. Don't worry about that.
Well, all right, you go after Arthur, said Mrs. Weasley. Now, when you get into the fire, say where you're going, and keep your elbows tucked in, Ron advised. And your eyes shut, said Mrs. Weasley. The soot!
Don't fidget, said Ron, or you might well fall out of the wrong fireplace.
But don't panic and get out too early. Wait until you see Fred and George.
Trying hard to bear all this in mind, Harry took a pinch of flue powder and walked to the edge of the fire. He took a deep breath, scattered the powder into the flames, and stepped forward. The fire felt like a warm breeze. He opened his mouth and immediately swallowed a lot of hot ash.
The Diagon Alley, he coughed.
It felt as though he were being sucked down a giant drain. He seemed to be spinning very fast. The roaring in his ears was deafening. He tried to keep his eyes open, but the whirl of green flames made him feel sick. Something hard knocked his elbow, and he tucked it in tightly, still spinning and spinning. Now it felt as though cold hands were slapping his face. Squinting through his glasses, he saw a blurred stream of fireplaces and snatched glimpses of the rooms beyond. His bacon sandwiches were churning inside him. He closed his eyes again, wishing it would stop, and then he fell face forward onto cold stone and felt the bridge of his glasses snap. Dizzy and bruised, covered in soot, he got gingerly to his feet, holding his broken glasses up to his eyes. He was quite alone, but where he was, he had no idea. All he could tell was that he was standing in the stone fireplace of what looked like a large, dimly lit wizard shop, but nothing in here was ever likely to be on Hogwarts school list. A glass case nearby held a withered hand on a cushion, a blood-stained pack of cards, and a staring glass eye. Evil-looking masks stared down from the walls. An assortment of human bones lay upon the counter, and rusty, spiked instruments hung from the ceiling. Even worse, the dark, narrow street Harry could see through the dusty shop window was definitely not Diagon Alley. The sooner he got out of here, the better. Nose still stinging where it had hit the hearth, Harry made his way swiftly and silently toward the door. But before he got halfway toward it, two people appeared on the other side of the glass, and one of them was the very last person Harry wanted to meet when he was lost, covered in soot, and wearing broken glasses. Draco Malfoy. Harry looked quickly around and spotted a large black cabinet to his left. He shot inside it and pulled the doors closed, leaving a small crack to peer through. Seconds later, a bell clanged and Malfoy stepped into the shop. The man who followed could only be Draco's father. He had the same pale, pointed face and identical cold grey eyes. Mr. Malfoy crossed the shop, looking lazily at the items on display, and rang a bell on the counter before turning to his son and saying, "Touch nothing, Draco." Malfoy, who had reached for the glass eye, said, "I thought you were going to buy me a present."
"I said I would buy you a racing broom," said his father, drumming his fingers on the counter.
"What's the good of that if I'm not on the house team?" said Malfoy, looking sulky and bad-tempered. "Harry Potter got a Nimbus 2000 last year, special permission from Dumbledore, so he could play for Gryffindor. He's not even that good, it's just because he's famous for having a stupid scar on his forehead."
Malfoy bent down to examine a shelf full of skulls.
"Everyone thinks he's so smart, wonderful Potter with his scar and his broomstick."
"You have told me this at least a dozen times already," said Mr. Malfoy, with a quelling look at his son. "And I would remind you that it is not prudent to appear less than fond of Harry Potter, not when most of our kind regard him as the hero who made the Dark Lord disappear. Ah, Mr. Borgin."
A stooping man had appeared behind the counter, smoothing his greasy hair back from his face.
"Mr. Malfoy, what a pleasure to see you again," said Mr. Borgin in a voice as oily as his hair. "Delighted, and young Master Malfoy, too. Charmed. How may I be of assistance? I must show you just in today, a very reasonably priced—"
"I am not buying today, Mr. Borgin, but selling," said Mr. Malfoy.
"Selling?"
The smile faded slightly from Mr. Borgin's face.
"You have heard, of course, that the Ministry is conducting more raids," said Mr. Malfoy, taking a roll of parchment from his inside pocket and unraveling it for Mr. Borgin to read. "I have a few, items at home that might embarrass me if the Ministry were to call." Mr. Borgin fixed a pair of pince-nez to his nose and looked down the list.
"The Ministry wouldn't presume to trouble you, sir, surely?"
Mr. Malfoy's lip curled. "I have not been visited yet. The name Malfoy still commands a certain respect, yet the Ministry grows ever more meddlesome. There are rumors about a new Muggle Protection Act. No doubt that flea-bitten, Muggle-loving fool Arthur Weasley is behind it."
Harry felt a hot surge of anger.
"And as you see, certain of these poisons might make it appear."
"I understand, sir, of course," said Mr. Borgin. "Let me see."
"Can I have that?" interrupted Draco, pointing at the withered hand on its cushion.
"Ah, the hand of glory," said Mr. Borgin, abandoning Mr. Malfoy's list and scurrying over to Draco. "Insert a candle, and it gives light only to the holder. Best friend of thieves and plunderers, your son has fine taste, sir."
"I hope my son will amount to more than a thief or a plunderer, Borgin," said Mr. Malfoy coldly. And Mr. Borgin said quickly,
"No offense, sir, no offense meant."
"Though if his grades don't pick up," said Mr. Malfoy more coldly still, "that may indeed be all he is fit for."
"It's not my fault," retorted Draco. "The teachers all have favorites. That Hermione Granger."
"I would have thought you'd be ashamed that a girl of no wizard family beat you in every exam," snapped Mr. Malfoy.
"Ah," said Harry under his breath, pleased to see Draco looking both abashed and angry.
"It's the same all over," said Mr. Borgin in his oily voice. "Wizard blood is counting for less everywhere."
"Not with me," said Mr. Malfoy, his long nostrils flaring.
"No, sir, nor with me, sir," said Mr. Borgin with a deep bow.
"In that case, perhaps we can return to my list," said Mr. Malfoy shortly. "I am in something of a hurry, Borgin. I have important business elsewhere today."
They started to haggle. Harry watched nervously as Draco drew nearer and nearer to his hiding place, examining the objects for sale. Draco paused to examine a long coil of hangman's rope and to read, smirking, the card propped on a magnificent necklace of opals. "Caution, do not touch. Cursed. Has claimed the lives of 19 Muggle owners to date." Draco turned away and saw the cabinet right in front of him. He walked forward. He stretched out his hand for the handle.
"Done," said Mr. Malfoy at the counter. "Come, Draco."
Harry wiped his forehead on his sleeve as Draco turned away.
"Good day to you, Mr. Borgin. I'll expect you at the manor tomorrow to pick up the goods."
The moment the door had closed, Mr. Borgin dropped his oily manner.
"Good day yourself, Mr. Malfoy. And if the stories are true, you haven't sold me half of what's hidden in your manor."
Muttering darkly, Mr. Borgin disappeared into a back room. Harry waited for a minute in case he came back, then, quietly as he could, slipped out of the cabinet, past the glass cases, and out of the shop door. Clutching his broken glasses to his face, Harry stared around. He had emerged into a dingy alleyway that seemed to be made up entirely of shops devoted to the dark arts. The one he'd just left, Borgin and Burke's, looked like the largest. But opposite was a nasty window display of shrunken heads, and, two doors down, a large cage was alive with gigantic black spiders. Two shabby-looking wizards were watching him from the shadow of a doorway, muttering to each other. Feeling jumpy, Harry set off, trying to hold his glasses on straight, and hoping against hope that he'd be able to find a way out of here. An old wooden street sign hanging over a shop selling poisonous candles told him he was in Nocturne Alley. This didn't help, as Harry had never heard of such a place. He supposed he hadn't spoken clearly enough through his mouth full of ashes back in the Weasley's fire. Trying to stay calm, he wondered what to do.
"Not lost, are you, my dear?"
said a voice in his ear, making him jump. An aged witch stood in front of him, holding a tray of what looked horribly like whole human fingernails. She leered at him, showing mossy teeth. Harry backed away. "I'm fine, thanks," he said. "I'm just..."
"Harry! What do you think you're doing down there?"
Harry's heart leapt. So did the witch. A load of fingernails cascaded down over her feet, and she cursed as the massive form of Hagrid, the Hogwarts gamekeeper, came striding toward them, beetle black eyes flashing over his great bristling beard.
"Hagrid!" Harry croaked in relief. "I was lost. Flu powder."
Hagrid seized Harry by the scruff of the neck and pulled him away from the witch, knocking the tray right out of her hands. Her shrieks followed them all the way along the twisting alleyway out into bright sunlight. Harry saw a familiar snow-white marble building in the distance, Gringotts Bank. Hagrid had steered him right into Diagon Alley.
"You're a mess," said Hagrid gruffly, brushing soot off Harry so forcefully he nearly knocked him into a barrel of dragon dung outside an apothecary. "Skulking around Nocturne Alley, I dunno. Dodgy place, Harry. Don't want no one to see you down there."
"I realize that," said Harry, ducking as Hagrid made to brush him off again. "I told you I was lost. What were you doing down there anyway?"
"I was looking for a flesh-eating slug repellent," growled Hagrid. "They're ruining the school cabbages. You're not on your own?"
"I'm staying with the Weasleys, but we got separated," Harry explained. "I've got to go and find them." They set off together down the street.
"How come you never wrote back to me?"
said Hagrid as Harry jogged alongside him. He had to take 3 steps to every stride of Hagrid's enormous boots. Harry explained all about Dobby and the Dursleys.
"Lousy muggles," growled Hagrid. "If I'd have known..."
"Harry! Harry, over here!"
Harry looked up and saw Hermione Granger standing at the top of the white flight of steps to Gringotts. She ran down to meet them, her bushy brown hair flying behind her.
"What happened to your glasses? Hello, Hagrid. Ooh, it's wonderful to see you two again. Are you coming into Gringotts, Harry?"
"As soon as I've found the Weasleys," said Harry.
"You won't have long to wait,"
Hagrid said with a grin. Harry and Hermione looked around. Sprinting up the crowded street were Ron, Fred, George, Percy, and Mr. Weasley.
"Harry," Mr. Weasley panted, "we hoped you'd only gone one grape too far."
He mopped his glistening bald patch.
"Molly's frantic. She's coming now."
"Where did you come out?" Ron asked.
"Nocturne Alley," said Hagrid grimly.
"Excellent," said Fred and George together.
"We've never been allowed in," said Ron enviously. "I should ruddy well think not," growled Hagrid.
Mrs. Weasley now came galloping into view, her handbag swinging wildly in one hand, Ginny just clinging onto the other.
"Oh, Harry, oh, my dear, you could have been anywhere."
Gasping for breath, she pulled a large clothes brush out of her bag and began sweeping off the soot Hagrid hadn't managed to beat away. Mr. Weasley took Harry's glasses, gave them a tap of his wand, and returned them good as new.
"Well, gotta be off,"
said Hagrid, who was having his hand wrung by Mrs. Weasley.
"Nocturne Alley, if you hadn't found him, Hagrid.
See you at Hogwarts."
And he strode away, head and shoulders taller than anyone else in the packed street.
"Guess who I saw in Borgin and Burke's?"
Harry asked Ron and Hermione as they climbed the Gringotts steps. "Malfoy and his father."
"Did Lucius Malfoy buy anything?"
said Mr. Weasley sharply behind him.
"No, he was selling."
"So he's worried," said Mr. Weasley with grim satisfaction. "Oh, I'd love to get Lucius Malfoy for something."
"You be careful, Arthur,"
said Mrs. Weasley sharply as they were bowed into the bank by a goblin at the door.
"That family's trouble. Don't go biting off more than you can chew."
"So you don't think I'm a match for Lucius Malfoy?"
said Mr. Weasley indignantly. But he was distracted almost at once by the sight of Hermione's parents, who were standing nervously at the counter that ran all along the great marble hall, waiting for Hermione to introduce them.
"But you're muggles," said Mr. Weasley delightedly. "We must have a drink. What's that you've got there? Oh, you're changing muggle money. Molly, look."
He pointed excitedly at the 10-pound notes in Mr. Granger's hand.
"Meet you back here,"
Ron said to Hermione, as the Weasleys and Harry were led off to their underground vaults by another Gringotts goblin. The vaults were reached by means of small, goblin-driven carts that sped along miniature train tracks through the bank's underground tunnels. Harry enjoyed the breakneck journey down to the Weasley's vault, but felt dreadful, far worse than he had in Nocturne Alley when it was opened. There was a very small pile of silver sickles inside, and just one gold galleon. Mrs. Weasley felt right into the corners before sweeping the whole lot into her bag. Harry felt even worse when they reached his vault. He tried to block the contents from view as he hastily shoved handfuls of coins into a leather bag. Back outside on the marble steps, they all separated. Percy muttered vaguely about needing a new quill. Fred and George had spotted their friend from Hogwarts, Lee Jordan. Mrs. Weasley and Ginny were going to a second-hand robe shop. Mr. Weasley was insisting on taking the Grangers off to the Leaky Cauldron for a drink. "We'll all meet at Flourish and Blotts in an hour to buy your school books," said Mrs. Weasley, setting off with Ginny. "And not one step down Nocturne Alley," she shouted at the twins' retreating backs. Harry, Ron, and Hermione strolled off along the winding cobbled street. The bag of gold, silver, and bronze, jangling cheerfully in Harry's pocket, was clamoring to be spent, so he bought 3 large strawberry and peanut butter ice creams, which they slurped happily as they wandered up the alley, examining the fascinating shop windows. Ron gazed longingly at a full set of Chudley Cannon robes in the windows of Quality Quidditch Supplies until Hermione dragged them off to buy ink and parchment next door. In Gamble and Jape's wizarding joke shop, they met Fred, George, and Lee Jordan, who were stocking up on Dr. Filibuster's fabulous Wet Start, no-heat fireworks, and in a tiny junk shop full of broken wands, lopsided brass scales, and old cloaks covered in potion stains, they found Percy deeply immersed in a small and deeply boring book called Prefects Who Gained Power. "A study of Hogwarts prefects and their later careers," Ron read aloud off the back cover. "That sounds fascinating." "Go away," Percy snapped. "Course he's very ambitious, Percy. He's got it all planned out. He wants to be Minister of Magic," Ron told Harry and Hermione in an undertone as they left Percy to it. An hour later, they headed for Flourish and Blotts. They were by no means the only ones making their way to the bookshop. As they approached it, they saw, to their surprise, a large crowd jostling outside the doors trying to get in. The reason for this was proclaimed by a large banner stretched across the upper windows. "Gilderoy Lockhart will be signing copies of his autobiography, Magical Me, today, 12:30 p.m. to 4:30 p.m.
"We can actually meet him," Hermione squealed. "I mean, he's written almost the whole book list."
The crowd seemed to be made up mostly of witches around Mrs. Weasley's age. A harassed-looking wizard stood at the door, saying,
"Calmly, please, ladies, don't push there. Mind the books now."
Harry, Ron, and Hermione squeezed inside. A long line wound right to the back of the shop, where Gilderoy Lockhart was signing his books. They each grabbed a copy of The Standard Book of Spells, Grade 2, and sneaked up the line to where the rest of the Weasleys were standing with Mr. and Mrs. Granger.
"Oh, there you are, good," said Mrs. Weasley.
She sounded breathless and kept patting her hair.
"We'll be able to see him in a minute."
Gilderoy Lockhart came slowly into view, seated at a table surrounded by large pictures of his own face, all winking and flashing dazzlingly white teeth at the crowd. The real Lockhart was wearing robes of forget-me-not blue that exactly matched his eyes. His pointed wizard's hat was set at a jaunty angle on his wavy hair. A short, irritable-looking man was dancing around taking photographs with a large black camera that emitted puffs of purple smoke with every blinding flash.
"Out of the way there!"
he snarled at Ron, moving back to get a better shot.
"This is for the Daily Prophet!"
"Big deal," said Ron, rubbing his foot where the photographer had stepped on it. Gilderoy Lockhart heard him. He looked up. He saw Ron, and then he saw Harry. He stared. Then he leapt to his feet and positively shouted,
"It can't be Harry Potter!"
The crowd parted, whispering excitedly. Lockhart dived forward, seized Harry's arm, and pulled him to the front. The crowd burst into applause. Harry's face burnt as Lockhart shook his hand for the photographer, who was clicking away madly, wafting thick smoke over the Weasleys.
"Nice big smile, Harry,"
said Lockhart through his own gleaming teeth. Together, you and I are worth the front page. When he finally let go of Harry's hand, Harry could hardly feel his fingers. He tried to sidle back over to the Weasleys, but Lockhart threw an arm around his shoulders and clamped him tightly to his side. "Ladies and gentlemen," he said loudly, waving for quiet, "what an extraordinary moment this is. The perfect moment for me to make a little announcement I've been sitting on for some time. When young Harry here stepped into Flourish and Blotts today, he only wanted to buy my autobiography, which I shall be happy to present him now, free of charge." The crowd applauded again. "He had no idea," Lockhart continued, giving Harry a little shake that made his glasses slip to the end of his nose, "that he would shortly be getting much, much more than my book, Magical Me. He and his schoolmates will, in fact, be getting the real magical me. Yes, ladies and gentlemen, I have great pleasure and pride in announcing that this September I will be taking up the post of Defense Against the Dark Arts teacher at Hogwarts School of Witchcraft and Wizardry." The crowd cheered and clapped, and Harry found himself being presented with the entire works of Gilderoy Lockhart. Staggering slightly under their weight, he managed to make his way out of the limelight to the edge of the room, where Ginny was standing next to her new cauldron. "You have these," Harry mumbled to her, tipping the books into the cauldron. "I'll buy my own."
"Bet you loved that, didn't you, Potter?" said a voice Harry had no trouble recognizing.
He straightened up and found himself face to face with Draco Malfoy, who was wearing his usual sneer.
"Famous Harry Potter," said Malfoy. "Can't even go into a bookshop without making the front page."
"Leave him alone. He didn't want all that," said Ginny.
It was the first time she had spoken in front of Harry. She was glaring at Malfoy.
"Potter, you got yourself a girlfriend," drawled Malfoy.
Ginny went scarlet as Ron and Hermione fought their way over, both clutching stacks of Lockhart's books.
"Oh, it's you," said Ron, looking at Malfoy as if he were something unpleasant on the sole of his shoe. "Bet you're surprised to see Harry here, eh?" "Not as surprised as I am to see you in a shop, Weasley," retorted Malfoy. "I suppose your parents will go hungry for a month to pay for all those."
Ron went as red as Ginny. He dropped his books into the cauldron too and started towards Malfoy, but Harry and Hermione grabbed the back of his jacket.
"Ron," said Mr. Weasley, struggling over with Fred and George, "what are you doing? It's too crowded in here. Let's go outside." "Well, well, well, Arthur Weasley."
It was Mr. Malfoy. He stood with his hand on Draco's shoulder, sneering in just the same way.
"Lucius," said Mr. Weasley, nodding coldly.
"Busy time at the Ministry, I hear," said Mr. Malfoy. "All those raids. I hope they're paying you overtime."
He reached into Ginny's cauldron and extracted from amid the glossy Lockhart books a very old, very battered copy of A Beginner's Guide to Transfiguration.
"Obviously not," Mr. Malfoy said. "Dear me. What's the use of being a disgrace to the name of wizard if they don't even pay you well for it?"
Mr. Weasley flushed darker than either Ron or Ginny. "We have a very different idea of what disgraces the name of wizard, Malfoy," he said.
"Clearly,"
said Mr. Malfoy, his pale eyes straying to Mr. and Mrs. Granger, who were watching apprehensively.
"The company you keep, Weasley. And I thought your family could sink no lower."
There was a thud of metal as Ginny's cauldron went flying. Mr. Weasley had thrown himself at Mr. Malfoy, knocking him backward into a bookshelf. Dozens of heavy spellbooks came thundering down on all their heads. There was a yell of, "Get him, Dad!" from Fred or George. Mrs. Weasley was shrieking, "No, Arthur, no!" The crowd stampeded backward, knocking more shelves over.
"Gentlemen, please, please!"
cried the assistant, and then louder than all,
"Break it up there, gents! Break it up!"
Hagrid was wading toward them through the sea of books. In an instant he had pulled Mr. Weasley and Mr. Malfoy apart. Mr. Weasley had a cut lip, and Mr. Malfoy had been hit in the eye by an encyclopedia of toadstools. He was still holding Ginny's old transfiguration book. He thrust it at her, his eyes glittering with malice.
"Here, girl, take your
book. It's the best your father can give you. Pulling himself out of Hagrid's grip, he beckoned to Draco and swept from the shop.
You should have ignored him, Arthur,
said Hagrid, almost lifting Mr. Weasley off his feet as he straightened his robes.
Rotten to the core, the old family. Everyone knows that. No Malfoy's worth listening to. Bad blood, that's what it is. Come on now, let's get out of here.
The assistant looked as though he wanted to stop them leaving, but he barely came up to Hagrid's waist and seemed to think better of it. They hurried up the street, the Grangers shaking with fright, and Mrs. Weasley beside herself with fury.
A fine example to set for your children, brawling in public. What Gilderoy Lockhart must have thought.
He was pleased, said Fred.
Didn't you hear him as we were leaving? He was asking that bloke from the Daily Prophet if he'd be able to work the fight into his report. Said it was all publicity. But it was a subdued group that headed back to the fireside in the Leaky Cauldron, where Harry, the Weasleys, and all their shopping would be travelling back to the Burrow using flue powder. They said goodbye to the Grangers, who were leaving the pub for the Muggle Street on the other side. Mr. Weasley started to ask them how bus stops worked, but stopped quickly at the look on Mrs. Weasley's face. Harry took off his glasses and put them safely in his pocket before helping himself to flue powder. It definitely wasn't his favourite way to travel. Chapter 5. The Whomping Willow. The end of the summer vacation came too quickly for Harry's liking. He was looking forward to getting back to Hogwarts, but his month at the Burrow had been the happiest of his life. It was difficult not to feel jealous of Ron when he thought of the Dursleys and the sort of welcome he could expect next time he turned up on Privet Drive. On their last evening, Mrs. Weasley conjured up a sumptuous dinner that included all of Harry's favourite things, ending with a mouth-watering treacle pudding. Fred and George rounded off the evening with a display of filibuster fireworks. They filled the kitchen with red and blue stars that bounced from ceiling to wall for at least half an hour. Then it was time for a last mug of hot chocolate and bed. It took a long while to get started next morning. They were up at dawn, but somehow they still seemed to have a great deal to do. Mrs. Weasley dashed about in a bad mood, looking for spare socks and quills. People kept colliding on the stairs, half-dressed with bits of toast in their hands, and Mr. Weasley nearly broke his neck, tripping over a stray chicken as he crossed the yard, carrying Ginny's trunk to the car. Harry couldn't see how 8 people, 6 large trunks, 2 owls, and a rat were going to fit into one small Ford Anglia. He had reckoned, of course, without the special features that Mr. Weasley had added. "Not a word to Molly," he whispered to Harry as he opened the trunk and showed him how it had been magically expanded so that the luggage fitted easily. When at last they were all in the car, Mrs. Weasley glanced into the back seat, where Harry, Ron, Fred, George, and Percy were all sitting comfortably side by side, and said, "Muggles do know more than we give them credit for, don't they?" She and Ginny got into the front seat, which had been stretched so that it resembled a park bench. "I mean, you'd never know it was this roomy from the outside, would you?" Mr. Weasley started up the engine and they trundled out of the yard, Harry turning back for a last look at the house. He barely had time to wonder when he'd see it again when they were back. George had forgotten his box of filibuster fireworks. 5 minutes after that, they skidded to a halt in the yard so that Fred could run in for his broomstick. They had almost reached the highway when Ginny shrieked that she'd left her diary. By the time she had clambered back into the car, they were running very late, and tempers were running high. Mr. Weasley glanced at his watch and then at his wife. "Molly, dear."
"No, Arthur. No one would see. This little button here is an invisibility booster I installed. That'd get us up in the air. Then we'd fly above the clouds. We'd be there in 10 minutes, and no one would be any the wiser." "I said no, Arthur. Not in broad daylight."
They reached King's Cross at 11:15. Mr. Weasley dashed across the road to get trolleys for their trunks, and they all hurried into the station. Harry had caught the Hogwarts Express the previous year. The tricky part was getting onto platform 9 3/4, which wasn't visible to the Muggle eye. What you had to do was walk through the solid barrier dividing platforms 9 and 10. It didn't hurt, but it had to be done carefully so that none of the Muggles noticed you vanishing.
"Percy first," said Mrs. Weasley, looking nervously at the clock overhead, which showed they only had 5 minutes to disappear casually through the barrier.
Percy strode briskly forward and vanished. Mr. Weasley went next. Fred and George followed.
"I'll take Ginny, and you two come right after us," Mrs. Weasley told Harry and Ron, grabbing Ginny's hand and setting off. In the blink of an eye, they were gone.
"Let's go together. We've only got a minute," Ron said to Harry. Harry made sure that Hedwig's cage was safely wedged on top of his trunk and wheeled his trolley around to face the barrier. He felt perfectly confident. This wasn't nearly as uncomfortable as using flu powder. Both of them bent low over the handles of their trolleys and walked purposefully toward the barrier, gathering speed. A few feet away from it, they broke into a run and... crash! Both trolleys hit the barrier and bounced backward. Ron's trunk fell off with a loud thump. Harry was knocked off his feet, and Hedwig's cage bounced onto the shiny floor, and she rolled away, shrieking indignantly. People all around them stared, and a guard nearby yelled, "What in blazes do you think you're doing?" "Lost control of the trolley," Harry gasped, clutching his ribs as he got up. Ron ran to pick up Hedwig, who was causing such a scene that there was a lot of muttering about cruelty to animals from the surrounding crowd.
"Why can't we get through?" Harry hissed to Ron. "I don't know."
Ron looked wildly around. A dozen curious people were still watching them.
"We're going to miss the train," Ron whispered. "I don't understand why the gateway sealed itself."
Harry looked up at the giant clock with a sickening feeling in the pit of his stomach. 10 seconds, 9 seconds. He wheeled his trolley forward cautiously until it was right against the barrier and pushed with all his might. The metal remained solid. 3 seconds, 2 seconds, 1 second.
"It's gone," said Ron, sounding stunned. "The train's left. What if Mum and Dad can't get back through to us? Have you got any Muggle money?"
Harry gave a hollow laugh. "The Dursleys haven't given me pocket money for about 6 years." Ron pressed his ear to the cold barrier.
"Can't hear a thing," he said tensely. "What are we going to do? I don't know how long it'll take Mum and Dad to get back to us."
They looked around. People were still watching them, mainly because of Hedwig's continuing screeches.
"I think we'd better go and wait by the car," said Harry. "We're attracting too much attention."
"Harry," said Ron, his eyes gleaming. "The car!"
"What about it?"
"We can fly the car to Hogwarts."
"But I thought we're stuck, right? And we've got to get to school, haven't we? And even underage wizards are allowed to use magic if it's a real emergency, Section 19 or something of the restriction of thingy."
"But your Mum and Dad," said Harry, pushing against the barrier again in a vain hope that it would give way. "How will they get home?"
"They don't need the car," said Ron impatiently. "They know how to apparate. You know, just vanish and reappear at home. They only bother with flu powder and the car because we're all underage and we're not allowed to apparate yet."
Harry's feeling of panic turned suddenly to excitement.
"Can you fly it?"
"No problem," said Ron, wheeling his trolley around to face the exit. "Come on, let's go. If we hurry, we'll be able to follow the Hogwarts Express." And they marched off through the crowd of curious muggles, out of the station and back onto the side road where the old Ford Anglia was parked. Ron unlocked the cavernous trunk with a series of taps from his wand. They heaved their luggage back in, put Hedwig on the back seat, and got into the front. "Check that no one's watching," said Ron, starting the ignition with another tap of his wand. Harry stuck his head out of the window. Traffic was rumbling along the main road ahead, but their street was empty.
"Okay," he said.
Ron pressed a tiny silver button on the dashboard. The car around them vanished, and so did they. Harry could feel the seat vibrating beneath him, hear the engine, feel his hands on his knees and his glasses on his nose, but for all he could see, he'd become a pair of eyeballs floating a few feet above the ground in a dingy street full of parked cars.
"Let's go," said Ron's voice from his right,
and the ground and the dirty buildings on either side fell away, dropping out of sight as the car rose. In seconds, the whole of London lay, smoky and glittering, below them. Then there was a popping noise, and the car, Harry and Ron, reappeared.
"Uh-oh," said Ron, jabbing at the invisibility booster. "It's faulty."
Both of them pummeled it. The car vanished. Then it flickered back again.
"Hold on!"
Ron yelled, and he slammed his foot on the accelerator. They shot straight into the low, woolly clouds, and everything turned dull and foggy.
"Now what?" said Harry, blinking at the solid mass of cloud pressing in on them from all sides.
We need to see the train to know what direction to go in, said Ron.
Dip back down again, quickly.
They dropped back beneath the clouds and twisted around in their seats, squinting at the ground.
I can see it, Harry yelled. Right ahead, there.
The Hogwarts Express was streaking along below them like a scarlet snake.
Due north, said Ron, checking the compass on the dashboard.
Okay, we'll just have to check on it every half an hour or so.
Hold on.
And they shot up through the clouds. A minute later, they burst out into a blaze of sunlight. It was a different world. The wheels of the car skimmed the sea of fluffy cloud, the sky a bright, endless blue under the blinding white sun.
All we've got to worry about now are aeroplanes, said Ron.
They looked at each other and started to laugh. For a long time, they couldn't stop. It was as though they had been plunged into a fabulous dream. This, thought Harry, was surely the only way to travel, past swirls and turrets of snowy cloud, in a car full of hot, bright sunlight, with a fat pack of toffees in the glove compartment, and the prospect of seeing Fred's and George's jealous faces when they landed smoothly and spectacularly on the sweeping lawn in front of Hogwarts Castle. They made regular checks on the train as they flew further and further north, each dip beneath the clouds showing them a different view. London was soon far behind them, replaced by neat green fields that gave way in turn to wide purplish moors, a great city alive with cars like multicolored ants, villages with tiny toy churches. Several uneventful hours later, however, Harry had to admit that some of the fun was wearing off. The toffees had made them extremely thirsty, and they had nothing to drink. He and Ron had pulled off their sweaters, but Harry's T-shirt was sticking to the back of his seat, and his glasses kept sliding down to the end of his sweaty nose. He had stopped noticing the fantastic cloud shapes now, and was thinking longingly of the train miles below, where you could buy ice-cold pumpkin juice from a trolley pushed by a plump witch. Why hadn't they been able to get onto platform 9 3/4?
"Can't be much further, can it?"
croaked Ron, hours later still, as the sun started to sink into their floor of cloud, staining it a deep pink. "Ready for another check on the train?" It was still right below them, winding its way past the snow-capped mountain. It was much darker beneath the canopy of clouds. Ron put his foot on the accelerator and drove them upward again, but as he did so, the engine began to whine. Harry and Ron exchanged nervous glances.
It's probably just tired, said Ron. It's never been this far before.
And they both pretended not to notice the whining growing louder and louder as the sky became steadily darker. Stars were blossoming in the blackness. Harry pulled his sweater back on, trying to ignore the way the windshield wipers were now waving feebly as though in protest.
Not far, said Ron, more to the car than to Harry. Not far now.
And he patted the dashboard nervously. When they flew back beneath the clouds a little while later, they had to squint through the darkness for a landmark they knew.
There! Harry shouted, making Ron and Hedwig jump. Straight ahead!
Silhouetted on the dark horizon, high on the cliff over the lake, stood the many turrets and towers of Hogwarts Castle. But the car had begun to shudder and was losing speed.
Come on! Rod said cajolingly, giving the steering wheel a little shake. Nearly there. Come on.
The engine groaned. Narrow jets of steam were issuing from under the hood. Harry found himself gripping the edges of his seat very hard as they flew toward the lake. The car gave a nasty wobble. Glancing out of his window, Harry saw the smooth, black, glassy surface of the water a mile below. Ron's knuckles were white on the steering wheel. The car wobbled again.
Come on,
Ron muttered. They were over the lake. The castle was right ahead. Ron put his foot down. There was a loud clunk, a splutter, and the engine died completely.
Uh-oh, said Ron into the silence.
The nose of the car dropped. They were falling, gathering speed, heading straight for the solid castle wall.
No!
Ron yelled, swinging the steering wheel around. They missed the dark stone wall by inches as the car turned in a great arc, soaring over the dark greenhouses, then the vegetable patch, and then out over the black lawns, losing altitude all the time.
Ron let go of the steering wheel completely and pulled his wand out of his back pocket.
Stop! Stop!
He yelled, whacking the dashboard and the windshield, but they were still plummeting, the ground flying up toward them.
Watch out for that tree!
Harry bellowed, lunging for the steering wheel, but too late.
Crunch!
With an ear-splitting bang of metal on wood, they hit the thick tree trunk and dropped to the ground with a heavy jolt. Steam was billowing from under the crumpled hood. Hedwig was shrieking in terror. A golf ball-sized lump was throbbing on Harry's head where he had hit the windshield, and to his right, Ron let out a low, despairing groan.
"Are you okay?"
Harry said urgently.
"My wand," said Ron in a shaky voice. "Look at my wand!"
It had snapped, almost in two. The tip was dangling limply, held on by a few splinters. Harry opened his mouth to say he was sure they'd be able to mend it up at the school, but he never even got started. At that very moment, something hit his side of the car with the force of a charging bull, sending him lurching sideways into Ron, just as an equally heavy blow hit the roof.
"What's happened?"
Ron gasped, staring through the windshield, and Harry looked around just in time to see a branch as thick as a python smash into it. The tree they had hit was attacking them. Its trunk was bent almost double, and its gnarled boughs were pummeling every inch of the car it could reach.
"Ah!"
said Ron, as another twisted limb punched a large dent into his door. The windshield was now trembling under a hail of blows from knuckle-like twigs, and a branch as thick as a battering ram was pounding furiously on the roof, which seemed to be caving.
"Run for it!"
Ron shouted, throwing his full weight against his door, but next second he had been knocked backward into Harry's lap by a vicious uppercut from another branch.
"We're done for,"
he moaned as the ceiling sagged. But suddenly the floor of the car was vibrating. The engine had restarted.
"Reverse!"
Harry yelled, and the car shot backward. The tree was still trying to hit them. They could hear its roots creaking as it almost ripped itself up, lashing out at them as they sped out of reach.
"That," panted Ron, "was close. Well done, car."
The car, however, had reached the end of its tether. With two sharp clunks, the doors flew open, and Harry felt his seat tip sideways. Next thing he knew, he was sprawled on the damp ground. Loud thuds told him that the car was ejecting their luggage from the trunk. Hedwig's cage flew through the air and burst open. She rose out of it with an angry screech and sped off toward the castle without a backward look. Then, dented, scratched, and steaming, the car rumbled off into the darkness, its rear lights blazing angrily.
"Come back!"
Ron yelled after it, brandishing his broken wand.
"That'll kill me!"
But the car disappeared from view with one last snort from its exhaust.
"Can you believe our luck?"
said Ron miserably, bending down to pick up Scabbers. "Of all the trees we could have hit, we had to get one that hits back." He glanced over his shoulder at the ancient tree, which was still flailing its branches threateningly.
"Come on," said Harry wearily. "We'd better get up to the school."
It wasn't at all the triumphant arrival they had pictured. Stiff, cold, and bruised, they seized the ends of their trunks and began dragging them up the grassy slope toward the great oak front doors.
"I think the feast's already started," said Ron, dropping his trunk at the foot of the front steps and crossing quietly to look through a brightly lit window. "Hey, Harry, come and look. It's the sorting."
Harry hurried over, and together he and Ron peered in at the great hall. Innumerable candles were hovering in midair over four long crowded tables, making the golden plates and goblets sparkle. Overhead, the bewitched ceiling, which always mirrored the sky outside, sparkled with stars. Through the forest of pointed black Hogwarts hats, Harry saw a long line of scared-looking first years filing into the hall. Ginny was among them, easily visible because of her vivid Weasley hair. Meanwhile, Professor McGonagall, a bespectacled witch with her hair in a tight bun, was placing the famous Hogwarts sorting hat on a stool before the newcomers. Every year, this aged old hat, patched, frayed, and dirty, sorted new students into the four Hogwarts houses, Gryffindor, Hufflepuff, Ravenclaw, and Slytherin. Harry well remembered putting it on exactly 1 year ago and waiting petrified for its decision as it muttered aloud in his ear, For a few horrible seconds, he had feared that the hat was going to put him in Slytherin, the house that had turned out more dark witches and wizards than any other. But he had ended up in Gryffindor, along with Ron, Hermione, and the rest of the Weasleys. Last term, Harry and Ron had helped Gryffindor win the house championship, beating Slytherin for the first time in 7 years. A very small, mousy-haired boy had been called forward to place the hat on his head. Harry's eyes wandered past him to where Professor Dumbledore, the headmaster, sat watching the sorting from the staff table, his long silver beard and half-moon glasses shining brightly in the candlelight. Several seats along, Harry saw Gilderoy Lockhart, dressed in robes of aquamarine, and there at the end was Hagrid, huge and hairy, drinking deeply from his goblet.
"Hang on," Harry muttered to Ron. "There's an empty chair at the staff table. Where's Snape?"
Professor Severus Snape was Harry's least favorite teacher. Harry also happened to be Snape's least favorite student. Cruel, sarcastic, and disliked by everybody except the students from his own house, Slytherin, Snape taught potions.
"Maybe he's ill," said Ron hopefully. "Maybe he's left," said Harry, "because he missed out on the Defense Against Dark Arts job again." "Or he might have been sacked," said Ron enthusiastically. "I mean, everyone hates him."
"Or maybe," said a very cold voice right behind them, "he's waiting to hear why you two didn't arrive on the school train."
Harry spun around. There, his black robes rippling in a cold breeze, stood Severus Snape. He was a thin man with sallow skin, a hooked nose, and greasy shoulder-length black hair. And at this moment he was smiling in a way that told Harry he and Ron were in very deep trouble.
"Follow me," said Snape.
Not daring even to look at each other, Harry and Ron followed Snape up the steps into the vast echoing entrance hall, which was lit with flaming torches. A delicious smell of food was wafting from the great hall, but Snape led them away from the warmth and light, down a narrow stone staircase that led into the dungeons.
"In,"
he said, opening a door halfway down the cold passageway and pointing. They entered Snape's office, shivering. The shadowy walls were lined with shelves of large glass jars, in which floated all manner of revolting things Harry didn't really want to know the name of at the moment. The fireplace was dark and empty. Snape closed the door and turned to look at them.
"So," he said softly, "the train isn't good enough for the famous Harry Potter and his faithful sidekick Weasley. Wanted to arrive with a bang, did we, boys?"
"No, sir, it was the barrier at King's Cross. It—"
"Silence!" said Snape coldly. "What have you done with the car?"
Ron gulped. This wasn't the first time Snape had given Harry the impression of being able to read minds. But a moment later he understood, as Snape unrolled today's issue of the Evening Prophet.
"You were seen,"
he hissed, showing them the headline, "Flying Ford Anglia Mystifies Muggles." He began to read aloud.
"Two muggles in London convinced they saw an old car flying over the post office tower. At noon in Norfolk, Mrs. Hetty Bayliss, while hanging out her washing, Mr. Angus Fleet of Peebles reported to police. 6 or 7 muggles in all. I believe your father works in the Misuse of Muggle Artifacts office,"
he said, looking up at Ron and smiling still more nastily.
"Dear, dear, his own son."
Harry felt as though he'd just been walloped in the stomach by one of the Mad Tree's larger branches. If anyone found out Mr. Weasley had bewitched the car, he hadn't thought of that.
"I notice in my search of the park that considerable damage seems to have been done to a very valuable Whomping Willow,"
Snape went on. "That tree did more damage to us than we—" Ron blurted out.
"Silence!" snapped Snape again. "Most unfortunately, you are not in my house, and the decision to expel you does not rest with me. I shall go and fetch the people who do have that happy power. You will wait here."
Harry and Ron stared at each other, white-faced. Harry didn't feel hungry anymore. He now felt extremely sick.
He tried not to look at a large, slimy something suspended in green liquid on a shelf behind Snape's desk. If Snape had gone to fetch Professor McGonagall, head of Gryffindor House, they were hardly any better off. She might be fairer than Snape, but she was still extremely strict. 10 minutes later, Snape returned, and sure enough, it was Professor McGonagall who accompanied him. Harry had seen